My name is Roger Lewis. I am the underwriting director of an insurance company called ITIC. I have been the underwriting director at ITIC for 5 years. Before that, I was a claims handler at ITIC, where I worked for a gentleman called Mr. Andrew Jameson. Both of us have worked together for nearly 20 years, both at ITIC. So we hope to give you a good introduction and also some detail into the ITIC products this afternoon. Before I joined ITIC, I studied maritime law at Cardiff University and joined the graduate trainee scheme of a container shipping line, which I think is quite well known to you, called Evergreen. After 1 year with Evergreen, I discovered that selling space in metal boxes was not for me, but claims and the problems that arise in the shipping industry were much, much more interesting, so I joined the insurance community. 20 years later, I have the enjoyment of coming back to Taiwan and to Taipei, full circle after my introduction to shipping with Evergreen Shipping Line. Andrew's just going to give himself a short introduction, and hopefully he will not tell you all about the years when I worked as a claims handler for him.
Hello.
This one.
As insurance say, everyone can make mistakes. That was my first mistake. Hello, and thank you for the honour of inviting me to speak to you today at this function. I am an English lawyer. I qualified as a lawyer a long, long time ago. Sometime in the 80s, when Mr. Lewis was still at school. And I joined ITIC as a lawyer in 1990, so I've been a little longer than Roger. My job is as the claims director to look after the claim servicing that we do. Roger now sells the insurance as the underwriting director, and when he's got the money, I spend it. Alternatively, I'm there, as I always have been, to clear up his little mistakes. So my job at ITIC is to look after claims. We will develop today, so I won't tell you all about it now, but we have both the insurance for errors and omissions, and also we run a debt collection service collecting unpaid disbursements and commissions for our members. But I'll say more of that later. I'll now give you back to Roger, who will talk a little bit about ITIC and the services it provides.
Okay. The loss prevention, risk management, ship brokers, ship agents. We're going to cover both of these maritime professions this afternoon. Before we get there, a little bit of background then about who is ITIC, who are the people, the company that is talking to you. ITIC is a very specialist insurance business. We do not provide motor insurance, we do not provide general commercial insurance. The only people we look after are people like you. And in actual fact, the insurance company, ITIC, is owned by the maritime industry. It is not owned by any bank or large insurance business. It is owned by the people who it insures. It is what's called a mutual insurance business. So our customers choose what insurance they want. If you wish to change the insurance, you, as a member of ITIC or an insured, you can come and talk to us and say, I need insurance for this, I need insurance for that. So it's very flexible. On the screen in front of you are a list of marine professionals, agents, brokers, marine surveyors, naval architects who design ships, managers of ships and offshore equipment. All of these people have one thing in common. When they are working, they dress and wear clothes like you and I. So it is professionals who are working in shipping that we specialize in. ITIC does not insure the ships themselves, the cargo. It just looks after the professionals who provide these services. You can also see reference at the bottom of the screen to other transport modes. A bit of aviation, a bit of rail. Some of the professionals that we look after are engineers. They are designing railway systems and aircraft. So marine engineering, rail engineering, aviation engineering, it's all fairly similar. And it can all be taken care of by ITIC. What is it then that customers of ITIC are hoping to benefit from? What insurance do they want? You can see that it is called professional indemnity. Professional indemnity, or PI. Now, that is not protection and indemnity, or P and I. Very close, those two, and often mixed up. Protection and indemnity is what is purchased by a ship owner, as I'm sure you know, for their third-party liabilities, and well taken care of by our local correspondent here. Professional indemnity, PI, is an insurance in case, on a day-to-day basis, you make a mistake in your work which causes a financial loss to your principal. By principal, I mean your customer, the owner, maybe the charterer, maybe the buyer of a ship or the seller. There is also insurance for legal costs if there is a dispute. And as Andrew mentioned, as well as defending claims, as a member of ITIC, you can go on the attack and we can help you chase after commission or outstanding port agency disbursements. So you will see today, through the use of claims examples, the type of product that members of ITIC benefit from. So a bit more then about the structure of ITIC. How big is it? Who do we insure? And for what? Before I go there, a little bit about where ITIC is situated. We sit in a family of companies in the Thomas Miller Group with headquarters in London. ITIC, TT Club, which insure ports and terminals, a separate insurance business, and the UK P&I Club, who also happen to be in Taipei today, providing third-party liability insurance for ship owners. The Thomas Miller Group employs nearly 300 people worldwide in about 6 locations, providing specialist insurance in the marine industry. So back to ITIC. Working together since 1925, more than 80 years of providing specialist insurance. There are 2,000 members, as we call them, or customers, around the world in more than 100 countries. And in total, they pay ITIC an insurance premium close to $50 million. This makes us about the same size as some of the smaller shipowners' P&I clubs. It is an underwriting success story. I would say that as the underwriting director, but that is evidenced by the free reserves which ITIC has developed. Every year, the club receives $50 million in premium. We pay claims, costs, expenses, and make an underwriting profit, which is put into a free reserve of $80 million. This is our financial strength. In combination, they are assets of more than $100 million that we can show to the regulator in the United Kingdom about our solvency. We hope customers stay with us for a long time. Certainly, there are members here in Taiwan and in the Far East who've been with us nearly since the beginning of our history. One of the attractions is that if you join ITIC as a member company for your insurance, not only do you benefit from insurance protection, advice, support, but it is also an investment. Because would you believe it, every year, if we make an underwriting profit, you share in some of that profit. So we pay a dividend every year to renewing members of ITIC, and have done since 1995. I am not going to ask you to open an insurance policy document, start at the top, and read every word to you. Insurance is not very interesting. The way to make insurance interesting is to understand what claims, what support it provides. So, for the rest of this presentation, Andrew has promised me he will not mention a particular policy clause and a particular exclusion, but we are going to talk about day-to-day interaction with our members, the types of problems we see, and we're very, very welcome, very pleased to answer questions, either as we go along or at the end. So that is a introduction. ITI, what we're going to do now is, and we're going to both do a bit of a presentation. Andrew is going to take you through some of the claims and insurance cover that is provided to our members who provide ship broking services. So Andrew will also introduce a bit about the concept of ship broking, and then talk about the types of problems we see. I will then talk a bit more about ship agency, and then we're going to finish together with a joint presentation about our debt recovery service. Are there any questions at this point? Thank you. Right, over to you, Andrew.
Hello again. This part of the presentation is about one area that we insure, that of the activity of ship brokers. There are, throughout the world, companies that provide ship broking as their main activity. We also insure a lot of people. We both act as ship agents, representing the ship while it is in port, but also provide a ship broking service, arranging charter parties, and employment for vessels. We also insure most of the world's sale and purchase shipbrokers, who act as specialists arranging for the sale of second-hand vessels, and indeed arranging contracts for new buildings. So if I just show you my diagram up there, there is the shipbroker in the middle, and all around him there are all these particular legal threats and potential liabilities that he can have a problem with. And there, between the shipbroker and the threat, is his ITIC insurance. However, I'd just like to stress one thing. We provide a very comprehensive insurance policy, especially for shipbrokers and ship agents, but insurance is never the whole answer. If you make a mistake Sometimes it may not actually cost a financial loss, but it can, as a professional, lose you the client. So as a mutual insurer, and as Roger explained, we are owned by our membership and we are there to serve our membership, we also use some of our time explaining to our members where we have seen claims coming from, and hopefully they will not make the same mistake. So it is, loss prevention is very important. It's not simply, as a mutual insurer, a question of writing out the check. Yes, if it's appropriate, if there is a claim, that is what we are there to do. But we also try to show people the sort of mistakes that they have made, and therefore you can learn from other people's experience and hopefully not make the same mistake as other people have done. I'm going to start with the top of the diagram, negligence. I'm not going to give, and I've promised Roger I would not give any legal lecture today, but basically negligence, anyone, in legal terms, anyone who is providing a service has an obligation to provide that service with reasonable skill and care, and if you fall short of the standards required, then you would be liable to pay damages. And that is really the fundamental basis of professional negligence insurance. That is what we are here to cover, the mistakes. But let's not worry about legal definitions. Let's look at sort of examples. This was one case that I handled a couple of weeks ago. It just finalised, so it's quite fresh. It was for a broker in Europe, and the ship broker was arranging a COA, a contract of affreightment, a contract covering two shipments. He did this in January of this year. The contract was to be for two shipments. The first shipment was to take place in the summer, and the second one in October, which is why it's just finished. When they started negotiating, the charterer had only said he wanted to ship the cargo from one port. He wanted to have two shipments, but only from one port. Then during the negotiations, he said, actually, I would like the option to use a second port, a second name port. The first one was in Spain, and the second one was in the south of France. So the broker said to the owner, they would like an option to have a different load port. And the owner said, well, I don't mind about that, but check with the local agents, both whether the port is suitable for the vessel, and also if there are any costs. So the broker contacts the agent and says, look, can you just confirm the vessel is suitable? Oh, and can you give me a pro forma DA, just so the owner knows that if there are any unexpected costs. The first thing he gets back is, yes, the vessel is suitable for the port, which is nice because we have a lot of ship agents who've got that one wrong. But yes, this vessel can go in the port. So he passes that information to the owner. And they start talking about other matters and the rates, etc. And he receives a message from the port saying, the additional costs of going to that port will be $75,000, because to get the ship in, you're going to have to use two tugs, and that's going to cost you more money. Somehow the broker missed that message when it came in, so that information was never passed in January to the owner. So his owner agrees to do the fixture, agrees to do the two shipments, but he thinks there's no additional cost for the second port. Of course, we go forward to June. Yes, the charter wants to use the option port, and all of a sudden, the owner's got a bill for $75,000 worth of tugs, but he was not expecting. Obviously, he can't get that money from the charterer because he hasn't contracted to do that. But he is going to get it from the shipbroker, because his point is, I would never have made that deal to go to a second port if you had told me the truth, which is what the agent now tells me he told you, but it would be $75,000 more. So a simple failure to pass on a message by a shipbroker, and the topic gets lost in the negotiations. But you can see a simple error, and immediately for the first shipment, the broker is having to pay $75,000 for the tax. Then, of course, we had to wait for October. Would the charterer want to go to the option port? Well, when you're a claims handler, it's always the bad things that happen. So yes, they wanted that. So my claim goes up to 150,000. So there was the insurance to put in place to meet the damages caused by the broker's negligence. But a simple example of a shipbroker making an error. I think I'd like one thing for those people who do negotiate as brokers and as agents, for you please to try and remember. These things are really good, but it remains true that brokers send less and less in writing. They spend more and more time on the phone, and if they didn't, we'd have far less claims and far less problems. It remains true, and it's been true for my entire career of 22 years at ITIC, that the greatest single way of avoiding misunderstandings is to ensure that, whenever possible, important details are confirmed in writing. Sadly, we have people time and time again who fail to do so. I can just give you a couple of examples. This was a tanker broker, and there was a problem at the refinery where they had arranged for the vessel to go, and the charterers requested the option to cancel the voyage. The owners advised the broker that if they wanted to cancel, fine, but the cancellation fee would be the total freight minus the port costs and deviation. And the port costs and deviation would be about 21,000. Yeah, call it 21,000. So the owner says, cancellation, total freight minus about 21,000 for the deviation. The broker passes on the message to his charter just by telephone. He just rings up and says that. Charter says, I'll get back to you. Then the charterer comes back and says, yep, we'll cancel the voyage, and we'll cancel it at the quoted cost of $21,000 in full and final settlement. The broker then picks up the phone to the owner and says, the charterers have agreed to your proposal, but he hadn't understood that the charterers had not heard properly what the cancellation was. The cancellation was the freight less 21,000, not 21,000. So by misunderstanding, because it's on the telephone, you get an owner who believes he's going to get an awful lot more than the charterer thinks he's going to pay. And again, as the broker, they will look to the broker for the difference. Mm-hmm. It's very easy on the telephone, especially late at night, these things tend to happen. Brokers are under pressure, speak a little too quickly. It's very easy for that sort of matter to happen. So I will repeat, if you go away with one thing from today, the greatest simple way of avoiding misunderstandings is to ensure that, whenever you can, important details are confirmed in writing. I get a lot of brokers say to me that, hey, my principal doesn't like putting things in writing to me. Well, if he gives you an important instruction in writing, just confirm it back to him. It doesn't take long to tap out an email. A lot of what we see is very, very simple mistakes. Some of it, I'm afraid, is just a slight lack of attention to detail by the broker. We have a case quite recently where the broker was arranging a subcharter. This is a dry cargo matter. So he's arranging a subcharter, and is often the case, in fact normally the case, the main terms of the subcharter were fixed with the details otherwise as per the head charterer. So you have a head charter, you're negotiating a subcharter, and you say, apart from the bits we agree, the main terms otherwise as per that head charterer. So naturally, the sub-charterer says, well, send me the head charter party for me to review. Obvious thing to do. Now, unfortunately, the head charter had been sent to the broker, and with the charter party on one PDF was another PDF with a separate addendum. And you're beginning to guess these, aren't you? Because unfortunately, the broker only passes on the charter party and doesn't actually look and see there's two documents and doesn't pass on the second one, the addendum. So now, what do we have? We have a sub-charterer who's asked what the head charter is, and all he has got is the charter party and not the addendum, which mattered because the addendum contained provisions in relation to the costs of hold cleaning in the event that the vessel carried cement. When they had originally done the head charter, you weren't allowed to carry cement. But they'd done the addendum to allow the head charter to carry cement, but it said if you carry cement, you charterer pay to clean the holds afterwards, because it's a pretty horrible dirty cargo, it gets everywhere. So that's the cost. But under the sublet, yes, they'd agreed to carry cement, but because they hadn't passed on the addendum, no, the sub-charterer didn't know that he was going to be expected to pay for the costs of cleaning the hold. Not only did he not know he was going to be expected to, but of course his sublet didn't have any provision that made him do so. So this is how you then end up with a charterer in the middle, very cross, because he has got a head charter which says you will pay to clean the holds, but he has sub-chartered it and he can't get the money back from the sub-charterer because you, the broker, have failed to pass on both documents. Very, very simple mistake, but again, just being a lack of attention to detail. Just a second. So, often when we lecture young shipbrokers, take more care is a rather key piece of loss prevention and legal advice, but I'll do a few more specific things showing where common errors come from. Everyone will tell you, check the message, proofread the message, look carefully at the terms of the message, check what you're sending, check the dates, check the rate, check everything. One of the funny things is that the bit that people often forget to proofread is who they're sending the message to. Because they look all the way through the details of the message, but don't actually look to see who it is, where it's going. And we've had a number of problems with this, and a particularly unfortunate one is sending a private message to a mailing list and not to the client it's meant to go to. So we had a long analysis of the client's proposed 6-month COA, lots of valuable business information, but unfortunately the memo was sent to virtually every rival broking house in the world and a good deal of the principal's competitors, simply because the guy sent it, didn't look, and he'd sent it to a mailing list and not to the individual client. I like these because it's always entertaining to deal with them. We have a case a few years ago. It was a charterer, and he invited tenders for a very long-term time charter. This was a very, very attractive bit of business, and he put it out to tender. The broker involved discussed it with his owner, his principal, the ship owner. He said, make sure you get your bid in on time, because there was a time limit for tender. Don't play around at the last minute. Send it in now. I know what my bid is. So they agree what they're going to bid for this. But unfortunately, rather than send it to the charterer, the broker sent his owner's bid accidentally to a mailing list, on which was every competitive owner in the market. Now, as you'd imagine, the owner didn't actually secure the business, because very strangely, everyone else undercut him. However, he then complains to the broker I didn't get the business because you are an idiot who sent it to everyone. That may or may not be true. And in fact, we never paid any damages on this one, but that broker's never worked for that owner again. Mm-hmm. And what I said about trying to share experiences as a mutual insurer, it's not always just about money. Another cause of email misdirection.
Excuse me, I have a question.
Yeah.
So in that case,
take the microphone.
Go on, take the microphone.
Okay. In the case you just mentioned, the ship broker is not claimed by the owners, and you don't have to pay any indemnities in that case. But do you pay for his losing his client?
No.
So, okay.
You can never compensate for the fact that the principal will never want to fix with you again. We actually would have paid for legal costs, but I actually did that one in-house. The point was, but of course, the owner couldn't prove that he wouldn't have been undercut anyway, but it's just his view of his broker was completely destroyed by one small moment of sending that to the wrong party. Another cause of email misdirection is unfortunately people using the reply button instead of the forwarding button. So there is a rather big difference. We had a broker who received an offer from the owners that was subject to a charter party, and it had a very short period for acceptance. So the broker looks at it and thinks, actually, we've got to do this. So he adds his own comments recommending his principal accepts, and he puts on the end, you should accept this because it's a rising market, and if the owners don't fix with you, you'll be able to get more money elsewhere, so accept it. And he intended to send that on to his charterer, who would then of course do the business. Unfortunately, rather forwarding the offer, he pressed reply and sent it straight back to the owner. And the owner's quite interested by the fact that the charterer's broker thinks that if he doesn't do this deal, he's going to get a better deal elsewhere. So he does nothing. And then when the time limit expires, he thanks them very politely, says to the charterers, well, you're out of time, so we're going to work the vessel elsewhere. The charterer then has to, of course, get a ship at a much higher price because the market's gone up. He's looking at what he knows his broker now has recommended him to do and says, I'm now paying A. If it wasn't for you, I paid B. B is less than A, and you, broker, are paying the difference. So, again, very simple error causing in that case a charterer to bring a claim. We deal with a lot of those, so simple mistake, but please be careful. As people fix charter parties, there is a common problem that people will concentrate on the main terms of a fixture. And they will sometimes, at the end, be too casual with the details. Because for those of you who don't do shipbroking, how brokers will arrange charters is to do the main terms, and then, which is just the basic details, and then they will add on the sort of full contractual terms, which they will call the details. Now, the tendency is unfortunately to be a bit slack when they're looking at the details. And we've had a number of cases where the brokers perhaps should have been a bit more careful about what other terms were being added on to the fixture at the end. Because while there is a rule of law that if there is an inconsistency between specially negotiated terms and terms which are just on a standard form contract, like a pro forma charter party, then the negotiated terms will take preference. However, it's a very, very small rule. It has very limited application. Because if the court can read the document as a whole and make sense of it, then that is what they will do. The fact that it doesn't actually turn out saying what you meant it to say won't stop the court doing it. Let me give you an example. I actually don't know how this story ends because it's ongoing at the moment. But we have a charter party, and in the main terms, what's particularly negotiated, it says that the charter party will include, it's a long-term time charter, a minimum of 2 times Gulf of Aden transit. Now, at the moment, the Gulf of Aden has severe piracy problems, and so it was very important for charterers to know that they could transit the Gulf of Aden. So that's what they put in the main terms of the charter party. The broker then rather rapidly said, oh, all the rest of it is as per, and he gave a name of a previous charter to just incorporate the terms of the deal. And unfortunately, those terms included something called the BIMCO Piracy Clause. And the BIMCO Piracy Clause says that if the owner feels it is unsafe, he doesn't have to go. So now the broker has got a situation where he was talking directly to both the charterer and to the owners, and the charterers feel quite clearly that they have a contract there which gives them the right to do 2 Gulf of Aden transits. The owner thinks that that's all very well, but I have a contract there that also says that if I don't want to do those Gulf of Aden transits because of the piracy problems, I can say no. One of them is going to end up disappointed, and one of them is going to go for the shipbroker. Because of just not paying attention to the whole terms of the contract, looking at it as a whole. So that's a rather important case, which we will see how that one ends up. I think my next bit of advice would be called check before replying. It's very easy to do. I had a claim last summer where the broker was acting for the owners of the vessel and it was trading in the Mediterranean, and they received an offer from potential charterers, and the question was that the owner asked, this guy wants to go to Algeria, what are the working days in Algeria? Because that relates to what, how much time I can spend in the port and what are the port working days. The broker didn't think to check. He simply thought, it's an Arab country. So the weekend's going to be from close of business hours on Thursday and we'll resume again on Sunday morning. Had he just bothered to look in the BIMCO holiday calendar, that's not true in Algeria. The time goes all the way through until Sunday. You've just cost your owner 24 hours when the port doesn't work, and he's certainly going to want you to compensate for that lost time. Always check before you answer. It's just so easy just to think, I know the answer to that, and get that wrong. We had another one where this is rather more expensive. Broker should have gone back to and looked at what the charter party actually said, because he was talking to his owner about another matter, and the owner said, I've got an option to extend the fixture, and that's got to be declared sometime, hasn't it? Unfortunately, the broker did it off the top of his head and said, yeah, you've got a couple of weeks, don't worry about it. Actually, it was next Friday. So, of course, the owner then says, they didn't then declare the option, so the option expired, all because the broker has given negligent advice. And unfortunately, the broker had to pay the costs involved in fixing a vessel at a higher cost. And I think this is my absolute favourite. Someone who didn't bother reading the head charter party, the one between the head owner and the charter, and actually fixed a sublet for a longer period than they'd actually hired the ship for. So if you accidentally hire out your vessel for longer than you in fact have hired it in, you have a bit of a problem there.
How much did that cost?
I think that cost the best part of, thank you, I can't remember exactly, but it was the probably, by the time we persuaded them to do the extension, somewhere in the region of 800,000, 900,000, because it was quite a long period.
But Dollars?
Oh, okay. Yeah, dollars.
US or Taiwan?
US. Sorry, I'm in Taiwan. US dollars. most of these things are done in US dollars, sorry. I must remember that.
How much did the broker earn on the fixture?
How much would the broker earn on that fixture? 1.25% of the freight. So for a very small earning, you can cause an enormously large problem. So that's one particular area there. Another, in this communications, it's funny how we all get used to the ease of communications. But one thing we've had happen a number of times is you'll get someone say, look, it's a holiday. This was one from America, an American broker, and he was dealing with someone in Belgium. And the Belgian sent him a message saying, there is a public holiday in Belgium. We are not going to man the office. Could you, for any communications whatsoever, send to this email address or use this mobile telephone? Someone overlooked it, sent a message. They were trying to get a ship to change direction. They sent the message to the standard message. It wasn't picked up, and the ship steamed in exactly the wrong direction for 24 hours. And then, of course, you have to turn it around, and that's 24 hours coming back. So that's 2 days you're going to pay for, simply for not reading and taking in a message. So it's very easy, and this is what, as an insurer, we're here to help with. It's very easy to make an elementary mistake like that. Right, I think moving on.
Round the wheel.
I didn't actually go particularly round the wheel. Don't worry, not every topic's as big as negligence. So I've only got to misrepresentation. We live in very, very difficult financial times. Most of the world economy is in a bit of a mess. And it's sadly a fact of life that businesses will cease to operate, people will go into liquidation, cease to trade, not honour their commitments. It's also, unfortunately, a fact of life that the creditors of bankrupt companies, with no one else to turn to, will frequently allege that the reason they did that bit of business was because of something that their broker had said. So it must be very, very careful if you're asked about the financial standing or the business history of a company. Just A, not to be too enthusiastic. I know there's a desire to do business, but you need to be reasonable about what you say. And also, you must really make sure that if you're just passing on information that their people have provided themselves, you make it clear that's what you're doing. So if you get a background on charterers and you're passing it to owners who are going to hire their ship to these charterers, just make it clear that you say charterers advise as follows and then give the list. Don't allow the owners to say, oh, you, Mr. Broker, told me this, this and this was factual from your own knowledge. Be very careful about what you say about that sort of thing.
First class.
The next thing is, same slide, misdescription. And that's really an error, a statement about the ship or cargo. We have a large number of claims that arise because of brokers who just take information from databases and their own databases and publish it without ever checking with owners what they've put forward is correct. And sometimes you can get quite a lot of a number of fixtures made with the same wrong information in it before it gets discovered. We had one case involved the vessel's LOA, which was misstated, and unfortunately, having been used in fixtures on 5 separate occasions, the error was detected when the vessel encountered a lock, because in reliance on what had been given by the broker as to the vessel specifications, they'd fixed it to do a piece of business which involved going through a lock, and the vessel was simply too long. However much you try, you'll never get the ship to go through and shut the doors of a lock. So we ended up, as an insurance company, having to pay to barge the cargo through the lock, and where it was loaded onto another vessel, and that was a significantly large claim. There are all sorts of errors that you can make in relation to describing a ship or cargo. I think the most frequent one is probably errors on the speed and performance figures of the vessel. And the reason for that is they become out of date over the history of the vessel. So where, if you had in your database information about a vessel from 5 years ago, the ship probably isn't going to go that fast anymore. And so that often is a source of contractual argument. And people will say, well, where did the figures come from? And they will point at the broker. So always check vessel specifications before each piece of business. My next concern on the misdescription is, and especially dealing in places like here where there are linguistic difficulties, you'll be surprised how translating company names wrongly can cause problems if there's subsequently a dispute. We have a lot of people who don't take quite enough care over getting the exact identity of parties to a fixture. So you often get initials used, you often get sort of vague group names used. And then if there's a problem and the lawyers become involved, you'll get an argument as to who the contract was with. So you really need to be very careful to make sure that what you do is get the name properly recorded. We get an awful lot of that sort of case. Moving on to my next topic, breach of warranty of authority. This is the most unfortunate threat for shipbrokers, simply because it doesn't rely on the broker doing anything wrong. Let me try and explain it this way. If you are going to act as a broker or an agent for any principal, you go into negotiations on behalf of that principal, you are deemed as a matter of law to be warranting, holding out, that you have that principal's authority. If you don't have that principal's authority for any reason, then you could be held liable to anyone who's relied upon your warranty of authority. And this is easy to see with an example. And this is actually quite expensive. Brokers in London arranged a time charter, 2 years, between owners, and I have to change the names, well-known shipping company limited, or guaranteed nominee as charterers. All the communication on the charterer side were conducted between the brokers and someone I'll call Austin Carriers, just to change the name. They're both Chinese, by the way, but I didn't tell you that. After they negotiated the deal and they did a charter party, a message was received, allegedly from the well-known Chinese company, but sent via Austin Carriers Limited, saying that Austin Carriers Limited were nominated as charterers and that Austin Carriers Limited were therefore guaranteed by the well-known Chinese shipping company. So the vessel gets delivered to Austin Carriers, and we know now that they had a sub-charter. Austin Carriers paid the first 7 months hire and then stopped. Now, I know now the reason they stopped was because their sub-charter stopped and they were just making a turn of it. So eventually, after desperately trying to make contact with Austin Carriers, the owners cancelled the charter party for non-payment. So they appoint their lawyers through their defence, P&I Club, and the owners' lawyers then approach the well-known Chinese company demanding that they honour the guarantee. Which is much scratching of the head and looking surprised, as the well-known company replied they had absolutely no knowledge of this fixture, and when also the written guarantee was a forgery, but they had no individual of that name, that's not their chop, etc., etc. So you can see that my English broker has dealt with Austin carriers in good faith. Every information he got was from them. But now there's a fixture which had a remaining 15 months to go. A very, very expensive fixture, and the owners haven't been paid, and they're not going to be able to fix that vessel for anything like that price. So they mitigate their damages, get a fixture at the then current market price, and then they wonder what they're going to do, because Austin carriers have disappeared. But it was, after all, the broker who had dealt with them and warranted authority. The broker was from one of the big international broking houses, and so they sued them for breach of warranty of authority. You said you had authority to this fixture, to arrange this guarantee. You didn't. Therefore, you are liable to me. And the claim was for $3.9 million, plus interest, plus costs. A rather painful and very large claim. Shipbroking will always have an element of trust involved in it. But if that trust is misplaced, then it can be very expensive. And please think of this. You may not actually be able to totally eliminate and avoid the bad guys, but it does help if you're careful about the people you deal with and take steps to think of that. Always also be careful of guarantees, because guarantees are something slightly strange under English law. And what it is that you and I can make an agreement under English law. Many charter parties are subject to English law. You and I can make a verbal charter party. You and I can just agree that you'll hire my ship, and it's legally binding. Proving it might be difficult, but it's in theory legally binding. A guarantee is not like that. A guarantee has to be in writing, and so always bear that in mind. And also, bear in mind to make sure you have actually got a guarantee. There was a Hong Kong case a few years ago when the words read, performance and payments, TB, guaranteed by, and then the name of the company. And the court said, well, that's very interesting, but that's actually, to be guaranteed isn't a guarantee. Read the wording. Simple. A lot of these come down to be careful and just read. My next topic, defamation, is libel and slander.
I have a question about the breach of warranty of authority in that case. Yes, thank you. My question is that the broker was so sort of innocent because he was caught by the forgery guarantee from a famous Chinese shipping company.
Yeah.
If the owner frees this broker's assets, will ITIC issue letter of undertaking, letter of guarantee to release his freezing assets, just like the PNI insurance they are practically doing?
In terms of freezing the assets, we normally fight the case off, because in fact, under those circumstances, you don't have in that jurisdiction the ability to freeze people's assets in that way, so it doesn't arise. We don't, as a professional indemnity insurer, habitually put up guarantees. Normally, we end up settling the cases, and it doesn't really arise, because we tend to get appointed at an early stage, and we tend to negotiate it from there. So that's not something that tends to arise for us. And in fact, normally, because the opposition are funded by a defence club, if we're involved, they will normally then settle down and negotiate it without undue problems. So it doesn't tend to arise in practice for shipbreakers. Okay. Libel and slander. One of the things that I'd just like to stress is that we now live in a world of social media, Twitter, Facebook. Just because you put it on social media doesn't mean you can say what you like. It's funny how if you do put it there, even if you think you can take it down, The complainant will have a screen grab before you know it. So don't make the mistake of saying dumb things on Twitter. If you wouldn't put it in any other medium, don't put it in a social medium. We've had all sorts of stupid things put on. Don't say that the reason that Korean Charter's got the business is because they provided, I think the expression is adult entertainment. Don't put messages about bribery. We have seen throughout many countries a lot of tightening up on the law and anti-bribery law, particularly in my own country, the UK, but also in America, most of Europe, and throughout most of the world. It is a worldwide trend. And brokers have to be now very, very careful about arranging to pay commissions to people who perhaps weren't obviously involved in a fixture. We've had a number of cases where someone will perhaps, a chartering manager say, oh, in addition on this fixture, you have to pay a commission to, and then they'll give you a name and an account, etc. You've got to be now very careful because there are very, very stringent anti-bribery laws. And so that's an area where what used to be done can no longer be done. And I will visit you in prison if you do it, but that's all I can do. That's another one of those things insurance companies can't do. It can't get you out of prison for criminal affair. So be very careful. There's a worldwide trend towards that. We've had a lot of sanctions involved in shipping in the last few years. A lot out of the Middle East, which has disrupted some trades. And all I can say is be extremely careful about doing that. Brokers also provide market reports and valuations, and where we have seen people complain as to about market reports and shipbrokers being accused of misvaluing vessels. That's a rather specialist area. So since Roger's just coughed twice, that was my cue to give him the microphone back. We're going to talk about commission and the debt collection we do later, so I'll leave my last topic from then and I'll give you back to Roger.
Thank you, Andrew. Just to wake myself up and to wake everyone up. It's okay for you. You've not heard that before. I've heard that several times. And it's a sobering news for those of you who are shipbrokers or who would like to be shipbrokers. It's not straightforward.
It's scary.
Very. The numbers are very big. Ship agency. I think maybe there are a few more ship agents in the room than ship brokers. So if you think you've escaped, you're wrong. Because I've got a question for the audience. Who can tell me one thing that a ship agent is responsible for? Nice, easy question. The principal?
Yep.
Anything else? What else do ship agents do? I have a list here to help. They book cargo. They quote rates of freight. They arrange the berthing and loading. And release import cargo. In fact, ship agents always believe that the ship brokers take all the glory and the ship agents solve all the problems. This is true. When I talk about ship agent in the next 30 minutes, I mean ship agent, port agent, tramp agent, liner agent. They're all the same thing for the purposes of this presentation, but of course they're all slightly different, and we will look at those. A quick example then of a mistake made by an agent.
which resulted in an ITIC claim. The agent was appointed to book a berth for a ship so that it could come in and refuel to provide bunkers, so-called bunkers for the ship. But due to an oversight, the booking was not made. As the ship approached the port, news reached the master that if he wanted to come into that port for bunkers, he would have to wait for 5 days for the berth to be free. Sensibly, he made the decision to steam 500 kilometers away to the nearest port that was available, but this presented additional costs of about $50,000, which were passed to the agent for payment. So when we're talking about ITIC insurance, it is mistakes that are made, oversights, things that are forgotten. On the screen behind me are two ship agents. One is wearing a white hat and one is wearing a yellow hat. They are having a conversation. And I like to think that there is a question that they are asking each other. Whose agent am I? You would think it would be simple. Agent, ship, ship, agent. Now in the liner trade, and I know we have liner agent representatives here today, for you, you can relax. It's easy. You work for the line. In the tramp agency business, it's a lot more complicated. Because you spend all of your time with local customers, charterers, cargo coming in, being oil, going out, being electronic goods. You are working with the cargo. But actually, your customer is the ship. There are very experienced ship agents who forget that even if they are nominated or named by the charterer in a charter party, their duty of care, the duty that they owe, is to the ship owner. Confusion can cause problems. And this duty is the concept that is key to understanding the risk of a ship agent. Another common question that we get at ITIC is, there are disponent owners, time charterers, owners, who, they're all giving me instructions. They're telling me I can do this, I can do that, I can issue a bill of lading. There is only, in most circumstances, one principle that you should really think about. Unless you are clearly a protecting agent or clearly are a charterer's agent, in most circumstances, it is the agent for the carrier under the bill of lading that you need to think about. So, what are the types of things that can go wrong when an agent is trying to fulfill their duty for a principal? Well, I'm hoping that you have with you some papers which I sent in advance. And in those, not only is the presentation, I'm going to step over and have a little look here. There should be some bills of lading. We have, there we are. Thank you, Roger. Top left-hand corner says bill of lading. For my most valued customer from Mediterranean Shipping Company, this is not your bill of lading. We're coming to that one in a minute. I look forward to introducing myself later. I'm talking about the multimodal bill of lading.
Have a good look at this document. As I'm sure you know, one of the key duties of a ship agent is to deliver the cargo to the correct party. This is perhaps the most dangerous activity that a ship agent does. Why? Because the cargo has been given into the safe custody of the carrier at the load port. He has issued a bill of lading, receipt for the goods, evidence of the title ownership of the goods, evidence of the contract of carriage, a critical document, a bill of lading. And when the agent releases the goods, you are giving it away from the custody of the carrier. If it goes to the wrong party, you will probably never see it again. So, when you are presented a bill of lading, such as this one, an original bill of lading, quiz question number one, what's wrong with this bill of lading as an original? Look very carefully. I'll give you a minute or two. Scan your eyes all over the page. You're looking for an original bill of lading. Anyone want to be brave? Andrew? No, you've answered it before. If you look, I'll put you out of your misery, in the bottom right-hand corner, there is a little word stamped half across the text. Copy.
Sorry?
No, I mean it.
It says copy. This is not an original bill of lading. This is a copied bill of lading. It was sent by the shippers to the consignee, who has come in. He has not paid for his goods. He has come into the agent's office with a copy bill of lading and said, give me my cargo, and you've just given it away. What happened the next day? The person turned up with the original bill of lading. Where is my cargo? Now, luckily, in this case, it was a 40-foot container of new furniture. But if it was a more valuable consignment, which could be 50 containers of chrome ore or copper ore, it could be $1 million or $2 million. So releasing cargo, delivery of cargo without the original bill of lading, is the most dangerous thing that a ship agent does. And if you're not sure in your ship agency departments about a bill of lading, you should always escalate that up management so that someone can have a look at it. So bills of lading are critical documents. Not very exciting, but they are important. Because they are very important, the world of crime has identified bills of lading as a good way to earn money. Organized criminals forge bills of lading. They prepare fake documents. And with a note of thanks to my valued customers at Mediterranean Shipping Company for agreeing for me to present the next two pages to you, you can see two MSC bills of lading. They are both for the same shipper, the same notify party. If we look at the cargo description, Indian castor oil, yeah, 36 metric tons. Bottom left, freight prepaid, yeah. Shipped on board 30th of December 2007. Oof.
One of these is a genuine original bill of lading. The other one is a forgery produced by criminals. Question number two for the audience. Which one is the original and which one is the forgery? If you were a ship agent looking at these documents. I've got an early answer at the front which sounded encouraging. Anyone else? Well, you think that's the original? Yeah. Yeah. Congratulations to our representative from MSC who recognises his line's own bill of lading. The first document with the chop and stamp, top right-hand corner, is the original. The second one is a forgery. Now, would you believe it? If you turn over the next page, you can even see the back of that forged document. So they're very clever, these criminals. They've got the right, the clauses on there, and a stamp and a chop. Now, there is a point to make here that an agent is responsible to follow the instructions of the principal. However, here in this case, when ITIC was presented with the claim, we helped the agent to say, look, any agent would have been taken in by this. It's such a good forgery that you have used, and we used reasonable skill and care. So we do not believe that we are responsible. Reasonable, Andrew mentioned it, reasonable skill and care, the level of duty of care. In the first example with the copy, I'm afraid the agent had to pay. Mm-hmm. With this one, we put up the defence to say that it was reasonable. Any reasonable agent would have been taken in by such a thing. There is significant amounts of work done by container shipping lines to prevent fraud. Most bills of lading now have hidden watermarks that respond only to ultraviolet light or other means of recognising them. But if an agent is not sure, particularly in the tramp business, that a bill of lading is an original, you should seek instructions from the carrier under that document if you're ever suspicious. Okay, we've got 30 minutes to go.
Oh, just one question, Roger.
Sorry.
So what's the English court's decision on this MSC forgery case? Did you have it finally settled?
The law and jurisdiction under most international shipping lines bills of lading is, well, under many, is often English law. I believe that's also the case with MSC, although they prefer Swiss law, probably. But a lot of disputes end up in England because the courts there have a history of dealing with maritime disputes. The decision is that the carrier is responsible for the cargo when they issue a bill of lading as a receipt. You have given me your cargo in the load port. I will safely deliver it to the correct party. The carrier is liable in the event that these goods are given away to the wrong party. So not only MSC but other shipping lines have lost cases in the High Court in England where they've challenged their duty of care as a carrier when there's a very good forgery. The courts say you're responsible. It's your responsibility to have good documents that are will enable safe delivery. The agent, however, when the carrier pays the value of the cargo out as a claim and then tries to recover it from the agent is different. The agent, we can say, well, here it was reasonable that they should do it. So the carrier pays and cannot recover from the agent without help. Thank you.
telex release. Who here remembers what a telex is? One or two are nodding.
That one.
You need grey hair to remember what a telex is. It came before faxes. It's also a bit like vinyl records, LPs, and, you know, before CDs. Remember CDs? They're what we had before digital.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, so telex, telex release. Don't be confused by the word telex. This is just what it's called. There is a trend in shipping now for the bills of lading not to be transported through the banking chain and then be presented at the discharge port. For whatever reason, people are getting lazy and the bills sometimes get presented at the load port. So what happens is the goods are paid for correctly, the bills get presented still at the load port, and then the load port agent sends a message to the discharge port agent saying it's okay for you to telex release the goods. This communication between the two agents is critical, and often it gets misunderstood. When a load port agent says, I have the documents, that doesn't mean he's got the bills of lading, but how many discharge port agents think that is what it means and give away the cargo? We see it. So, telex release, what can you do? What is the loss prevention advice for telex release? Well, firstly, if you're a liner agent, follow your principal's instructions in the manual very, very closely. They're changing, and so there's so much of it happening that a lot of the major lines are changing their instructions. The other thing you can do is use the telephone. Sometimes we forget. We just send emails to each other. Phone up your friendly counterpart at the liner agency office in the load port who's just sent you the email and say, oh, hang on, what did you mean by I've got the documents? Are you sure you've got all three original bills of lading and it's okay for us to release the cargo? So, telex release, instructions, phone call. And that will save an awful lot of problems. Because if the cargo goes and is misreleased, it's likely that it will never be seen again. And the carrier or the principal will look to the agent. Okay, to finish this section, indemnities. LOIs, letters of indemnities, LOI. These come about, as I'm sure you know, when a bill of lading, original bill of lading, is not available. And the consignee says, I don't have the original bills. I'll tell you what, I'll give you a letter of indemnity which says, in the event that something goes wrong, I will indemnify you. A letter of indemnity is just a promise. If that promise is given by a company, the promise on a bit of paper is only as good as the assets of that company behind it. So if the cargo is worth $1 million and you get a promise from a trading company, it doesn't have any assets, its assets are four chairs and a desk. So do not be reassured by letters of indemnity. In fact, an indemnity, all the lights should come on. And you should escalate that up to management and say, right, you know, we've got to be very careful here with a letter of indemnity. It's not casual. It's a very serious, serious matter. There is a letter of indemnity that I gave out a bit late. It might be on the back page. Can you see at the back? It's landscape. Keep going. Sorry, right at the back. Yeah, last page. Have a look. Maybe share that one. It says low-cost packaging. You got it? low-cost packaging. Here is, have a read of that. That's a promise. Who in this room would be comfortable giving away a cargo worth $1 million on the back of this piece of paper? I'm glad to hear it. Everyone's shaking their head. I wish all ship agents were that careful. Be suspicious of letters of indemnity. A good letter of indemnity is the one that the carrier approves of. Your principal. Because if he says, that's fine, off you go. Nothing can go wrong, really. And if it does, it's his decision. So go back into the manual or go to the principal, the carrier, and say, these people have given this letter. Are you happy with it? Would you prefer it to be presented on the line's own words? And in fact, if you're a good ship agent, you will recommend to your carrier principal, let's get a bank guarantee on this letter of indemnity, a counter signature from the bank. He has to go to the bank and the bank will guarantee or support the promise that is being made. So that low-cost packaging, if they have to make the promise, it's their bank. Here there is no bank guarantee.
I have it all the time.
You did. A bit like ship brokers who are agents at law, ship agents are agents. And sometimes, unintentionally, you can attract a responsibility. If you order goods and services on behalf of a ship and you forget to identify yourselves as a ship agent, and the ship owner, who would normally pay for the bunkers or the water or the supplies, ceases to trade, as has happened, you will be responsible yourself. So placing purchase orders as a ship agent, we are XYZ shipping agents, we're ordering bunkers for and on behalf of a principal, signed off XYZ shipping company with some very magic words underneath the name of your company. Does anyone know what those are? Three words? As agents only. Order all of your goods and services as agents only, and then you will not be an unintentional principal, which is what this top bullet point is.
But Roger, do you know that under Taiwanese law, if you represent a foreign principal, under Taiwanese law, if the agent is representing the foreign principal, mm-hmm. and if he enters into a contract for and on behalf of the principal, under the law, the agent have to be jointly and severally liable with the principal under our law.
For more than cargo or just for everything?
More for everything, generally.
Okay.
If the law that governs the dispute is the law of Taiwan, that's harder to do. English law, which governs many maritime contracts, would give you more protection. Another difficult feature of the law of Taiwan is in relation to cargo. Because I understand that for export cargo, the agent is also jointly and severally liable for cargo claims or damage. Is that right? So, ship agents in Taiwan and in other places, the Middle East, Kuwait, there's another place, Spain in Europe, it is easier to look to the ship agent if the cargo is damaged than to a foreign ship owner. That also happens in respect of dock damage and In one case, I don't believe wreck removal has a liability in Taiwan, but just so that you know, you are fortunate to be ship agents in Taiwan, if ever you think that it's difficult. If you are a ship agent in the state of Qatar, you can be responsible for wreck removal. And the final bit of paper that I'm going to show you is a BIMCO wreck fix document, which is 4 pages. I don't know how often ship agents see a wreck removal contract. Probably not very often. It comes after the reverse of the bill of lading. It's rather small and it's a bit dark out there. But on section 10, there is the cost of removing a wreck from the port of Doha at $2.3 million. This unfortunate ship agent took the agency of this ship to load a cargo of fly ash, which I understand is a byproduct from the chimneys of power stations. The ship was owned by a single ship owning company in Dubai. In fact, they were brokers, but this was the first ship they'd bought, and they were unlucky because she sank in heavy seas as she left the port of Doha, blocking the port. And under the law of Qatar, an agent is jointly and severally liable for pollution, which was considered to be the need to remove this wreck with its fly ash and contaminants. So ITIC and its insurance responds where ship agents have a joint and several liability for cargo, dock damage, and wreck removal. Now, if the principal and their insurers pays, it's not a problem. But it is amazing when you have a $2 million wreck removal or a $1 million cargo claim, how many insurance companies, P&I clubs, disappear and leave the problem with the agent. What ITIC does is helps pull them back into the game, and if we're unsuccessful, then we pick up that contingent statutory liability. So wreck removal in Taiwan, nope. Cargo, yes. Maybe even unintentional principle, yes, depending on the circumstances. So that's an insight into ITIC's insurance product there. So Andrew and I are going to finish with a joint piece on the part of our product. We've now been talking about defending claims. We're now going to go on the attack and see how we can get you as a broker or as an agent in the last 15 minutes some of your well-earned money. I should say that for our $2.3 million wreck removal, the port agent earned an agency fee of $500. So that's why underwriting is just so difficult compared to claims handling. Andrew, there you go.
Roger's been quite modest about that because he, in fact, sorted out the wreck removal. I came in one morning and he said, I've got something to tell you about the arm, which was a ship involved. So I said, what, the wreck? And he went, yeah. He said, we've got two wrecks now. The salvage tug has just sunk on top of the wreck. So we unfortunately started with one wreck, and before we solved the problem, we had to deal with two wrecks. But that's why underwriters give me grey hairs. Debt collection. In fact, way back in 1925, our first members set up ITIC specifically because they wanted someone to pursue unpaid commissions, and it remains a very important part of what we do. Obviously, the world economy has been suffering for a period of time. In 2008, our number of debt collection files we handled just shot up. It went up something like 70%. And it fell back in 2009 to about sort of 80% of that. stayed about the same in 2010 and 2011, which is the last full figures I've got, it had gone back to an even higher level. So the actual number of claims files that we're handling is at the highest it's ever been. There are a few of these yearbooks at the back, and if some of you wish to, you can look at them, because it has the statistics, and it will show how we have had a peak in the number of debt collections. And that involves both ship brokers who have not received their commission and tramp agents who have not had the disbursement accounts or the balance of disbursement accounts paid. If ITIC's member approaches us and say we have... Well, first of all, we like them to approach us before they do business, because any of our members can ring us up and say, do you have a problem with this owner? Because, of course, we have a worldwide network of members, many of whom would have approached us about a bad debt. So we always actually encourage our members to say, if you are thinking of doing business with new owners, just try us out, just ring us up and see if we're actually pursuing them for bad debts. You might just avoid running up a bad debt yourself just by learning from our other members. So that's, before we even get to do business, that's something that we can do for you. But if, unfortunately, a ship agent is not paid, then the club will take up the cut. If they have a Rule 10 cover, or debt collection cover, we will arrange for action to be taken. Often, in fact, just threatening a message from the club will get the payment, because we've beaten the same ones several times, so when we appear on the scene, they normally know what will happen if they don't pay. And what will happen if they don't pay is, if they don't pay a ship agent, we will seek to arrest the vessel. And we frequently arrest vessels around the world for non-payment of ship agency disbursements. What we do want is people to report debts to us very quickly. There are two reasons for this. The first reason is, any business, the older a debt is, the harder it is to collect, because people don't like to have to drag up old invoices, and it's just a human factor. But the second is more important, that a lot of the disbursement accounts of ship agents will constitute something called a maritime lien, which means that you'll be able to go after the vessel, whether it's sold, come what may. But many of those maritime liens have a very short life, so you won't be able to enforce one after, say, 12 months. There's no standard, unfortunately, around the world, so you have to know the jurisdictions. But we need to act quickly for ship agents, and if we do, we can often detain the vessel until such time as either proper security is put up, or, in fact, we are more often paid, because it tends to be cheaper. We have a lot of cases for ship brokers at the moment, and I think the reason for that is obvious, that it's one of the easiest things to fail to do is actually not pay your broker, because a ship agent may actually be in a better position to stop you sailing if you start messing around with him, and often we advise ship agents what to do in that circumstance. But ship brokers often find they're rather low on the owner's priorities to pay commission, and so often we have to sue, we have to start arbitration proceedings, we have to take action against owners that way. So it is a very important part of the job. Roger said it's a joint act, so I'll hand it back to him for a second.
In your ITIC policy, when your company joins ITIC, we quote a separate premium for this cover, so it's not compulsory. You can choose to take it or not. Those that do are reminded that the debt has to be less than a year old, and that the debt has to be greater than a minimum sum insured. I'm afraid we can't chase after $100, but if the debt is more than $3,000, $3,500, your insurance kicks in and will pay the full legal costs of pursuing the matter to a recovery. 5 minutes to go and to finish. You are welcome to have a look at ITIC's website. It is free to access, has a lot of information in it about loss prevention, claims, a bit of legal advice.
You've heard some of the examples there today. We produce a number of different publications. One of the publications is called ITIC's Claims Review, and some of you may have picked one up. If you haven't, do not panic, because it's all available online. I'm going to finish by just referring to ITIC's Claims Review 26. So if you want to remember that, it's the one with the windmills on the front. It's a nice mauve cover. I can see some of the front here. It's available online. This claims review document tells short stories about problems that ship agents, ship brokers, surveyors have. And this is perhaps the most classic example of a mistake made by a ship agent that we've heard today. I'm going to read it. In early 2011, a ship agent at a tidal port in Japan was asked to provide a tide table to enable the owner of a ship to calculate the permissible draft for the dates that his ship was due to berth. Clearly, as the tide rose and fell, there was only going to be a limited time when he might be able to enter the port. The ship agent found the tide table in the office. He spotted it was the correct one. He had to fold it over because it had 2 years on it. So he folded it over. He went over to the scanner, pressed the button, sent it off, and it was safely received. Unfortunately, when he folded it over, in the corner, he hid the year. And he sent last year's. You can imagine when the ship arrived and had to wait to only work 1 hour a day, it cost a significant amount of money for 2 extra days loading. And as the story finishes, the ship had to shift anchorage 3 times during the 4 days it took to discharge, which was twice as long as it should have taken had the error not occurred. The owner claimed pilotage, towage costs, 2 days hire, additional bunker consumption, additional stevedoring, totaling $143,000. So, communication is perhaps the thing to be the most careful about. I hope this afternoon, it's been a long session, you've found something of interest. Our thanks, I'm sure Andrew won't mind me speaking on his behalf, again, to our hosts, Sotsun Law Firm and the Association. Both Andrew and I have enjoyed ourselves. Very happy to answer questions as we perhaps gather afterwards, and I'm very happy to give away some business cards. Thank you to those members of ITIC who are already here in the room, and to those of you who might be interested in encouraging your colleagues to join ITIC, feel free to refer them on to me as the area underwriter for our members here in Taiwan. Thank you all very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Thank you.